Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bug. I'm having some computer trouble, folks, so I can't see if you are in the chat or not. That is completely invisible to me right now. So maybe we'll just run audio. Who knows? Let's see. Okay. Good to go. Good enough. Welcome back to The Bug, everybody, live on Dave Martell YouTube channel every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. If you like The Bug, you support The Bug, make sure to patreon.com/The Bug and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, and most importantly, you get RSS feed to get the audio of every single show that we do to listen to in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/thebog. If you want to support us another way, make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and sign. Hey, go check out some sweet Bog merch. It's been a while since I did these plugs, so a little bit rusty. But shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and get yourself some sweet merch, man. We got hoodies, we got beanies, we got all the good winter stuff. We got dresses for the ladies, onesies for the babies. Go over there to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. Support a friend of ours. Make sure to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic Vedic astrology. Very, very cool stuff. Go give them a like. If you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. And yo, Bizarchives, guys, get yourself a copy of Bizarchives. It's blowing up on the screen here. I got the Bizarchives Cosmic Horror Double Feature. We got the Bizarchives 1 and 2 are both out, and we got another book coming. I can't tell you what it is because it's a surprise, but that's coming out very, very soon. So if you want to support indie publishing, awesome based fiction, go to thebizarchives.com and check that out, or follow us on Twitter and Telegram at The Bizarre Archives. And shout out to Mr. Tom, our buddy Tom at Survive the Jive. We got a cool ad running on his newest video there. It's pretty cool. So without further ado, tonight we're going to talk about war tech of the ancient world. And we got Mr. Tristan. Mr. Tristan's back. How are we doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. Glad to be back.
Hell yeah. So tonight we are going to talk about war tech, ancient war tech. And we are going to kind of go through the ages and pick some of the more iconic weapons that folks may or may not know about. We're going to talk about a lot of sidearms, and we're going to talk about some primary weapons. We're not going to get into ships or anything like that. We actually had a whole show talking about ships a while back. So if you want to go back, I believe it's called Mystery of the Endless Seas or Naval something or other. Go back and look through the videos and look for one that has a title that has to do with ships, and you'll find it. Me and Andre talk about it. I let Andre go wild with his vast nautical knowledge, and it's a good show. So go check that out if you want to check out about ships. But tonight we're going to talk about a lot of infantry weapons and stuff like that. And we're going to go through the ages. Like I said, we're going to pick out the iconic weapons, some of the more important ones, some of the more influential ones, and we're going to talk about it. We're going to start with the Stone Age, and we're going to go all the way up to the Iron Age and later. So we'll see how much we can get in. I'm going to get up on the screen here. We're going to talk about different weapons. But, Mr. Tristan, tell us about the Stone Age and kind of the weapons that were manufactured and used in the Stone Age.
So the weaponry of the Stone Age is mostly known for being the first time in which we combined rock weaponry with other manual uses, like a haft, wooden haft, slings, leather slings, that sort of apparel, and used them to strike and cut other things, which was a huge leap forward for humanity, because now we could, for instance, cut up pieces of meat or slice into an enemy and cause heavy bleeding, which is much more effective than trying to pummel or crush someone to death with your fists. But in here, we get also very economic weaponry, like axes, very good for cutting into bone and also cutting into wood. You know, a lot of these things have multiple uses because people weren't just warriors back then. This is back far enough where humanity had to be very multi-skilled. Everyone was a hunter and a warrior and a gatherer and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the Stone Age, their main weaponry that they invented here was the axe, the knife, the bow, spears,
You still there, Mr. Tristan?
Javelins, which are, you know, throwing spears, basically. Also, a new...
Mr. Tristan, are you there, sir? We're losing you.
The invention caught an... Yeah, my bad, guys. I'm having a bit of internet issues in and out, but we'll work through that. I was just talking about how the nifty invention of the Stone Age was the atlatl, which is a weaponry we'll talk about later.
Yeah, so I'm going to pull it up on the screen here in a minute as soon as I can find the button. And we're going to take a look at some of these Stone Age weapons. I'm just pulling it up on Google here. So we can just have a little bit of a visual. I can't seem to find the freaking button. Here we go.
Right. Well, while we do that, I will talk about the first dimension of the axe a little bit in depth. There are two main varieties of methods of producing an axe in this time period. The first one was to basically bore a hole using a rock, or even fire could be used to bore a hole through a thick wooden stump, and then fit in a pendulum of wood there, and then tie it around using some sort of twine, leather wraps, or any sort of plant material to the and affix it to a big haft of wood, and that would allow you to basically slice and slam that piece of wood into things and create a sort of makeshift axe.
And they also use right pitch there, too, right? Like glue, pitch.
Right. Pitch was also used to fix things in place and make sure they didn't come out, which was, you know, very easy, because it's hard if you're doing things by hand. You know, we're so used in the modern world to like machined tools where everything fits perfectly. But if you've ever tried to do anything by hand, it's almost impossible to get a snug, perfect fit.
And when we're scrolling through the images here, we're looking at a lot of spearheads and arrowheads and stuff like that. And the spears and arrowheads, very, very early on in the Stone Age, were actually pretty pivotal in identifying different cultures, because different cultures had slightly different manufacturing techniques for these spearheads and arrowheads and whatnot.
Right. The actual technique, which is flint knapping, that they're using here to produce them, are something that you would train generationally. Someone would have to be specialized to learn exactly how you create this exact object over and over and over again. They are surprisingly complex devices. When you're looking at them, they look maybe just like a, you know, sharp hunk of rock. But there's actually a lot of complexity going into them, exactly how the lines come out and to cut and pierce and everything like that. And because of that, different organizations of how to knap down these rocks traversed based on different locations and time periods. So it helps us categorize what people were interacting with who and when things went to different places and everything like that.
And in certain parts of the world, this kind of technique of creating these spearheads and these effectively sharp rock shards lasted pretty long. If you look at a lot of the weaponry that was in Mesoamerica until very, very late, was using things like obsidian and so on and so forth to still use Stone Age kind of weapons.
Yeah, I mean, it went on for many, many thousands, tens of thousands of years that we were using this sort of technology, and it's mostly because, by and large, stone weaponry and tools are, quote-unquote, good enough for primitive human survival that, for a lot of people, it just wasn't worth it to invest in the sort of specialized knowledge and wealth that would require metal smithing and everything like that.
Yeah. And
because, I mean, one of the things you have to take into account here is that the main benefit of a metal tool over a rock tool is that its durability. You can use it over and over and over and it won't really break. Whereas a rock tool had a unlimited shelf life, effectively. But if you're a hunter-gatherer, these people, contrary to popular perception, had far more free time than any settled agrarian people. Most of their life was spent not doing anything, hanging out, socializing over a fire, playing around, that sort of thing. So the main advantage in switching to metal weapons wasn't really worth it for a lot of hunter-gatherer people, because the main detriment to rock weaponry, that it took time and you needed to greet them more and more often, was actually a benefit to them because it gave them something to do in their downtime.
And as Tristan mentioned before, these were not this wasn't like a piece of crap. These were weapons for the time that were pretty sophisticated. They were pretty tough to make. There's actually some videos online of guys that replicate the process of making these Stone Age axes and knives and arrowheads and spearheads and stuff like that, and it's extremely difficult to make. Hours and hours and hours of very precise chipping, and to watch these guys do it and how frustrated they get because the flint, it'll blow apart, and it's just it was pretty sophisticated for the time. So next up on the list, I want to talk about, and this is probably one of the more important Stone Age inventions that some folks might not be familiar with, and this is the atlatl. Tristan, can you tell us about the atlatl?
Right, the atlatl is a very nifty invention, really. It's surprisingly simple, but also surprisingly effective. And basically what it was is a short stick that you held in one hand, and on the end of it had a little notch where you would put the tip of a javelin onto the notch. And that way, when you swing the atlatl forward, it would catapult the notch of the javelin and use centrifugal force to basically launch it far quicker and faster and more deadlier than any human could using their own muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so if you see here on the pictures here, you see the little notch at the end of it.
Yep.
That's where the atlatl sits onto the javelin and allows it to effectively throw it.
Very good. Yeah, these weapons were really, really effective. These weapons were generally used in the time of hunting mammoths. A lot of these atlatls are found among the peoples of Siberia, a lot of the steppe mammoth hunters. And one of the strategies that these Stone Age people would use to hunt these absolutely massive beasts, first of all, mammoth hunting was extremely dangerous. You know, the ancient mammoth was generally, they believed, to be smarter than the average elephant. It was more aggressive. It was a hell of a beast to hunt. It was bigger than your average elephant. It was a big, not just big, it was a huge, humongous, mean,
a huge, giant, blubbery elephant covered in a thick plate of fur used for the evolved for the Arctic conditions.
Yeah,
so
they were
imagine
tough.
An elephant with wearing armor, and it was also really pissed off and traveled in herds. So
yeah, so hunting these things, first of all, tracking them, they would track them for weeks. It was a tough job, very, very dangerous. But the atlatl, which you got to think, you got to remember, these, have you ever like made a spear at home just when you're a kid or whatever and hucked it, and it never, but a lot of the times it doesn't like stick right, it bounces off or whatever. It's not like the movies where everybody hurls these spears and they go and they sink 9 inches deep into the flesh of the target. No, a lot of these things miss, they bounce off, they don't harm. And think of the size of a mammoth, how many javelins, human-thrown javelins, would have to bring that beast down. So the atlatl was a huge, huge innovation for the time. The technique that they believe that these Stone Age people would use was they would lure or herd a single, usually an older or more hurt mammoth, or maybe a young mammoth, into like a place where they had an overpass, and they would trap them. And then a bunch of guys would jump up with atlatls and just rain atlatl like javelins down on these mammoths, praying that they kills it, right? And then they would that was kind of their hunting technique with the atlatl.
Yeah, more or less. And what we would really have to go here is that There's a trade-off when you're throwing a spear between the amount of damage and force you can exert on the one end of it and the amount of range you can get from it. So if you're throwing a spear, just picking it up and throwing it really far, when it hits something, it's probably not going to do a lot of damage. It'll bounce off. It'll not really do anything, right? But with an atlatl, it allows you to centralize so much force and power into it that, when it strikes something, it actually does do the Hollywood version of, you know, piercing in 9 inches and coming out through the other end of the animal. So it was very effective for hunting because it basically just allowed them to exponentially increase their own muscle force into the throw.
Yeah.
And for also, an atlatl allowed people to throw a javelin accurately up to twice as far, which is extremely relevant for hunters.
Yeah. And a lot of times these the javelins that they use specifically with the atlatl were a little bit smaller than a regular javelin or spear. So they were able to carry more. They would have more ammunition on them.
Yeah, a lot of them were more sort of like a mix between an arrow and a spear, actually. They were very specialized for long-range, accurate flight.
Yeah. So they were, I guess they would almost sort of be like a crossbow bolt, but larger. Yeah, very
cool. In fact, we could actually say that a crossbow bolt and a crossbow in general is almost like an upgraded version of an atlatl, yeah.
Very cool. Is there any other weapons you'd like to cover for the Stone Age?
Well, I mean, I figure most people know what a knife, an axe, and a spear look like, so we probably don't need to look there.
All right, so let's get into the more exciting stuff. Let's go into the Bronze Age. Tell me something to pull up here on the screen. Mr. Tristan. Oh, technology. Give me one second. I'll just look it up myself here until Tristan.
Sorry, can you repeat yourself, Dave?
Mr. Tristan, what would you like to go to first? Tell me what would you like me to bring up on the screen?
Let's go with a Kopesh.
A Kopesh.
From Egypt.
I believe it's K-H-O. Pesh.
Yeah, K-H-O-P-E-S-H.
Yeah, tell us about the Kopesh.
So the Kopesh is really the primary weaponry of the Egyptian infantrymen during the Bronze Age. And during this period, we also have to realize that Egypt and their main rival, the Hittites, were basically the two main superpowers of the Bronze Age. So when we're talking about either of these people, we're talking about the equivalency of using like an assault rifle today in a modern military. It's that prominent and extreme to characterize the age. Mm-hmm. So a Kopesh was effectively a heavily curved sword that was used for infantry. And it allowed them to slice into an enemy very effectively using bronze. Back and forwards, you could hook someone with it and also slice them on the other end. Which is very different from most of the swords we would think of today that have like a perpendicular figure where, you know, it's basically like a cross. You stab them, you can cut them, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But a Kopesh, as we see here, has a very heavy curve to it, which allows the bronze weaponry to slice into things. Very important for bronze because early bronze weaponry were not particularly great at slicing into things. They didn't keep an edge very well. So you needed every effort you could get to actually do this.
Yeah, quite the unique looking weapon that you don't really picture in your mind when you think of a sword. Now, the Kopesh, this is a sidearm. Even in ancient Egypt, the spear was still kind of the main weapon for infantry. However, the Kopesh was a very common, and it's mostly
right.
It's the iconic sidearm. It's like the katana of ancient Egypt.
Right. That is the primary sidearm weaponry of all the Egyptian infantry.
Yeah.
Of course, the spear is. For in all ages, the spear in all of its varieties has been the king of the battlefield because the ability to just outrange your enemy and poke them is extremely efficient, effectively.
Yeah. You see, with the Kopesh here, it is...
So, for the...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I was just going to say that the Kopesh is not... It's not really a... it's not a hard weapon to learn. If you can swing an axe, if you can swing a sickle, and I'm sure that this was modeled after, you know, farm equipment. That's why it's kind of called the sickle sword. It is something that you can give to a mostly untrained soldier, and he could be pretty effective with it. Unlike some of the sidearms that we're going to get into a little bit later. That was kind of the main deal behind the Kopesh, is it gave the wielder quite a bit of force. Like if you could see here, when you would slice, this is kind of like, I forget the terminology is here, but right here is kind of where this is where the business happens, right? Kind of on the end. And because of the curve of the blade, this here creates quite a bit of slicing force. You know what I mean? So just about any Joe Schmo jerk-off that can swing something could be effective with a Kopesh. But it's also interesting because the sickle sword, the Egyptian sickle sword, as Tristan mentioned, also functioned very well as a hooking weapon. A lot of these they had two sides. It was a very effective weapon for the time. There's a reason that they outfitted so much of their infantry with it.
Yeah, I mean, you can see here some of the varieties look like they might be specialized to grab like a shield and pull them down and then cut into someone.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what would you like me to bring up next here?
Let's go to an Egyptian chariot. The Egyptian chariots were actually called light chariots. Well, they didn't call them that, but we call them that to distinguish them from the heavier Hittite version. And the light chariot is a fundamental increase in military force of the time, characterized the Bronze Age entirely, and dominated all warfare during this time period. But the Egyptian light chariot differs primarily in the... its arrangement and the number of riders that it was allowed to have. Instead of being like a four-tone box, like people would imagine today, an Egyptian chariot only had two wheels, and it was attached to primarily one horse, effectively. And they had two people on board. They had a rider who was also doubled as a shield bearer. And they also had probably a professional soldier or a noble who would ride alongside in the chariot, and he was armed with a bow and probably also a spear to attack people if they came in close.
Mm-hmm. The Egyptian chariot was really an engineering marvel at the time because of, number one, how
this
light...
characterized the usage of what we would today refer to as heroic war.
You there, Mr. Tristan?
I am.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, your internet like cuts out for a minute, and then you come in sounding like a chipmunk. So.
Yeah, my bad, guys. I'm nothing really I can do about that. But when I notice it, I'll stop talking, and then I'll come back in. Yeah. It generally only takes a second or so.
It's all good. So yeah, I was saying that the Egyptian, the light chariot, was truly an engineering marvel of the time and gave them quite the edge in warfare. A lot of these pictures are showing two horses, but as Tristan mentioned, a lot of times these chariots ran one horse as well. And what was so unique about...
Yeah, you can definitely attach two horses to it without much of a problem, but the one horse is mostly because it was so light you could get away with it.
Yeah, it was, and a lot of folks, what led to this chariot specifically, it was the construction of the spoked wheel. The spoked wheel really, really changed the game when it came to ancient war tech, and I guess you could say ancient artillery, because before this, they had solid wheels, and you know, they're heavy, they're cumbersome, they're not very resilient, right? Whereas the spoked wheel could give a lot more give. It was a lot lighter. It was It was just a superior design. They could produce these fairly cheaply, a lot of them. And because of how wide their wheelbase is, I'm trying to find a picture here that kind of shows the Egyptian light chariot had a very wide wheelbase. And what this gave them was the ability to kind of turn very well without tipping or worrying about. So what the Egyptians would do with their chariot formations was almost like what kind of what the Mongols did later with their mounted archery, is that they would come and they would turn and they would turn at at shooting distance and just rain arrows on you from a distance and then move out of the way before you could react. And this battle tactic was really tough to beat, and it let allowed them to effectively destroy all of their enemies in the time until they started to catch up with rival technology, which many civilizations didn't. The Kushites, for example, didn't make up. They had very, very late. They had a little stint where they kind of pushed Egypt back, but eventually they were overwhelmed and conquered.
Yeah, and to go on to the next one, the Egyptians' main civilizational rival at the time was the Hittites, which are actually an Indo-European people. So this is the first massive proponent of the Indo-Europeans into the world stage. They invented the heavy chariot, which differs from the Egyptian light chariot in that it was generally a four-wheeled construction, and it also, instead of just two people on board, they generally had three or even four people. And they were much more heavily armed in an infantry sense. They would have an archer. They would have someone who was armed and armored with a shield and like a spear, so that when they would charge into someone, they could use that to gore people around them. And also, they would have the introduction of what was we would call heroic warfare. So one of the people, like a noble or a warrior in charge of the fourth person on here, would when they got into space into formation, they'd effectively just leap off the chariot and then do battle with anyone else around them, all the basically just slaughter a bunch of unarmed peasants effectively. And then when they got tired or they were backed into a corner and they needed to go, they'd call for their guy to come back, who would come up, pelt everyone with arrows, and have the spearmen on board rush to their defense, and then they'd hop on board and then leave back out of there, rest up, and then come back again for another jaunt of battle.
Yeah, and Tristan, I read somewhere that it was the Hittites that invented the chariot, and the Egyptians kind of borrowed the design. What do you know about that?
As far as I can tell, who actually invented the chariot seems to be very up in the air. There's a large argument that it was probably Indo-European people just because we were the first ones to domesticate horses, which is obviously a necessary component to a chariot itself. And we, have lots of war wagons at the time. But really, the technology spread so widely, it's really difficult to place down exactly where it started.
Yeah, and as you can see here, the Hittite war chariot, as Tristan mentioned, they would have three guys on it, and they were much heavier. They had much more of a wall around them that gave much more protection. The walls were a bit higher. It was pretty close in design to the Egyptian, except it was, it was just tankier. It was a tougher, had more defense, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, the one main difference here was that the
Cutting out, Tristan.
the Hittite heavy chariot was also used as something we would have All right, I'm back now. So, what as I was saying, that the Hittite heavy chariot was used in a way that we'd associate more with cavalry in the later period, where they would get everyone on board armed with spears and heavy armor and effectively just charge mass formations of people because the chariot was so heavy, and they'd have two or sometimes even three horses on there that they could just, and they'd attach giant scythes to the wheel, the wheels there, and they would effectively just mow down anyone in their way. You would have to get out of the way or get trampled by this giant fucking container here.
Yeah.
It would be like getting hit by a carriage or a wagon of some sort. You know, there's just nothing you could really do to mitigate that. So you'd effectively, it disrupted formations, which was also extremely useful from a tactical sense. So you could completely destroy an enemy's formation, wheel around, hit them all with arrows, and then charge them with infantry. And that's effectively how the Hittites fought.
Yeah. Tough people. What would you like me to bring up next, Mr. Tristan?
Let's go with the ancient Mycenae. So let's go with the Appa short sword.
All right. Let me see if I can find it here. I'm not really finding any good results, so you could just tell us about it.
Right. So the Appa short sword was effectively a bronze short weaponry used for massed Greek combat. They'd use it as paired as a sidearm alongside the short spear. And this is effectively the beginnings of hoplite warfare that we'd know from later classical periods. But all of these people are attired in super heavy bronze armor with gorgets all the way up, and It was almost the beginnings of plate armor. Like, these people were so massively armored, way beyond what they were often in the later classical period. Heavy bronze weaponry, heavy bronze shields, and they'd basically just bash into people with the, hit them with the spears, and then come in with the shield, and then stab them with the Appa short sword. And unlike the sickle weaponry, the Appa short sword is primarily a stabbing implement. It's very pointed, very sharp, and you can see here it has like a leaf blade design to it.
Mm. And this is what people, if you think of like the Spartans, this would be kind of the Spartan way of fighting, the Spartan tactic, and kind of, what's their short sword called? The Spatha or something like that? It's
no, the Spatha was Roman.
What's the Greek one called?
I'm not sure actually.
I forget what it's called. But
Hopis, maybe? Something like that. Typos. There.
So these blades, this is a technique and a design that was utilized in the Mediterranean by many, many cultures. And it really started with these guys. It started with a lot of this design. And as Tristan mentioned, the bronze or copper, they used quite a bit of copper as well. The breastplates, the helms, the stabbing weapon, with the shield, the spear, and the spear formations with the shields. This is something that existed through all of Greece. The Romans picked it up, and it was something that got used all the way through the Middle Ages and everything. This was a very effective style of combat, a tactic that was utilized for centuries and centuries.
Yeah, I mean, this is effectively ancient Mycenae. What we're talking about now is the time of the Trojan War. Mm-hmm. So this is how Achilles would have fought.
Yeah, incredible. So, what would you like me to bring up next, Mr. Tristan?
So let's go on next to the Iron Age, and we'll look up to the Dacian Falx, Falx.
Falx is such a cool weapon. This might be my favorite one on the list.
Oh, it's extremely cool. It's very iconic for the period. The Romans were themselves extremely terrified of the falx. And effectively, it's a it comes in two varieties. It comes in a one-handed and a two-handed variety. We'll focus on the two-handed variety as it's more representative of the what scared the Romans so much. But it's effectively a giant two-handed hooked sickle sword. that was used to cut down. So instead of cutting on the outside of the edge, they cut on the inside of the edge. And it had such amount of force behind it that it would... The Romans were terrified that it effectively would just clip right through their helmets. They actually had to reinforce the Legion helmets just to deal with the Dacians because they were hemorrhaging people to the fall.
Yeah. And another thing about the Falk's sword is not just the cutting power that it gets.
You can see here, very easy to bite into a shield with it.
Yeah. You there, Mr. Tristan?
I am.
Okay. We lost you for a minute. But with the thing with the Falk sword, if you could see here, of course it creates quite a bit of tremendous like cutting, biting power on the inside of the curvature of this blade. But the point, this is what the Romans when they started to march north, they started to outfit guys with more metal helmets because these blades coming down, that point, that stabbing point, would just plunge right through leather armor. It was a really effective, nasty little weapon. They were very, very light. They were designed from farming tools. It was a nasty little sword.
It was actually a brilliant weaponry, and it's very iconic to the Roman conception of quote-unquote barbarian peoples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool weapon. If you ever get a chance... Go ahead.
I was just going to say that next we should go on to the Spanish Copis, K-O-P-I-S. This is also a very iconic weapon of the Iron Age of the Roman period. And this is actually a type of sword that was adopted themselves by Rome, primarily amongst its officer class, but also amongst the Greeks as well. It's very common. It's considered that Alexander the Great himself had a copis sword from Spain.
Mm-hmm. It looks very similar to like a kukri or something like that.
Yeah, it's very similar to a kukri. It's effectively just an oversized sword version. But the same basic concept as a kukri, has that little notch inside of it that creates an edge there that creates a better cutting surface. Which, as you know, when we're looking at all these weaponry here, you'll notice that a lot of sidearm implements are very shaped for cutting in this method because... Even that small curve in the blade there can allow so much more force to be concentrated when it hits something that it makes it a much more effective weaponry.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of these, you'll see, have this kind of curve at the bottom of the hilt that kind of encases the hand. I do not believe that was what... the northern peoples used. I believe that the northern version of this weapon didn't have that. They had something more along the lines of this here, which is kind of like the curved kukri machete kind of handle. That this curvature, this kind of hand guard, was added later by the Mediterranean peoples.
Right. Well, I mean, the weaponry as itself comes from Spain, so we're effectively looking at a Mediterranean people to begin with, because Spain at this time was primarily populated by either Latin people, Gauls, or Carthaginians.
Mm-hmm.
And Carthage being a dominant trade naval power, they shipped their culture far and wide, and obviously their material possessions, so it was very common across the Mediterranean world.
Mm-hmm. So here's one from a dig here. Very cool weapon. Extremely cool weapon.
Yeah, let's look at now the Roman spatha.
All right. Everybody's
going to know this. So the first thing we'll note with the spatha is that this is effectively the... ancestral progenitor to what we would consider to be a Western European style sword. The spatha was primarily an elongation of the gladius, and it was used primarily by officers on horseback to give them that extra reach that they needed from horseback when they ran around and cut someone when they were charging.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it was introduced into the Germanic people, who were primarily very, very heavily organized at the beginning as a cavalry force. So a lot of them would have been very familiar with the spatha as their primary sidearm during this period, and the weaponry design transitioned extremely quickly into the Germanic people and up through into Scandinavia, and effectively is the progenitor of what we would consider to be a Carolingian sword, like a Viking era sword we would think of today.
Yeah, I was gonna say, this blade, this sword design here, really did not have a whole lot of change as we go into the Norman sword or the Viking sword, right? This design pretty much stayed the same. This is a very light, nimble blade. It is it's two-sided, obviously. Mainly designed for stabbing, but can also be used for slashing. This is a very effective sidearm. This is something that you can carry when you're traveling. It doesn't weigh you down when you're on horseback. It is very, very nimble and quick, flexible blade. It is the kind of the we're gonna get into Norse blades eventually, but kind of the stereotype that Norse warriors get is they use these big honking kind of weapons, and we'll talk about that. But a lot of these weapons were designed to be light and carried for travel and to be used quickly and stuff like that. These weren't big honking hunking things. These were very sleek, sophisticated, sharp, agile weapons.
Yeah, as I was saying, they were primarily introduced into the Roman military as a cavalry weapon. So they had to be light because Roman cavalry were, they didn't use even medium cavalry. They were all light cavalry. They couldn't really charge people because they hadn't invented the horse, the stirrup yet. So they would, if they ran into anyone, they would effectively just get knocked right out of the horseback. So the only thing they could really do was pass by someone and then slice into them as they went by. They couldn't really charge.
Yeah, and I would add that among Roman military, this sword was mostly a status symbol. It was obviously used and stuff like. But this was used by officers. This wasn't something that your average Roman was walking around with, because you know it's expensive to make these.
Also, the infantry forces themselves use the gladius, which is a lot shorter. It's more specialized for very up close personal confrontation. The distance of the spatha, like one of the main issues with the shield wall style of warfare, is that the longer weapons actually can be a detriment to you. That's why Germanic people primarily used the scrumma sacks when they got real close.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. We're running out of time pretty quickly. What do we got up next, Mr. Tristan?
I wanted to go into the Roman Pugio dagger.
Okay, let's bring that up here. Tell us about the Pugio.
So the Pugio dagger is a very common sidearm for any sort of Roman, not only in the military, but also in civilian life. It was primarily a stabbing implement, and it doubled as a shoveling tool for the construction of the legions. So it was a very versatile weaponry. Any Roman would have been immediately familiar with it, and it actually got a very sinister reputation as being a sort of an assassin's weapon, so like a cutthroat would use in Rome itself, because it was short enough that you could keep it on your person without it being aware that, you know, you had a weapon at all. Famously, Romans banned all weapons from their city. They didn't allow people to walk around with swords or anything of the like.
Yeah. And what's I believe it's pronounced Pugio. But this dagger, the Pugio dagger, was it was such a nasty dagger because of how it was a really wide, it's a really wide blade, and it's just a small weapon that it is easy to conceal, as Tristan said. It's it was associated with assassins. This thing is a this is a nasty blade. If you get stuck with this, it's it leaves a first of all, it's really wide, so it creates a very wide cut, a very wide stabbing wound, and it goes in very easily. It's got this nice hand guard that protects your hand, so when you plunge it in, your hand doesn't get cut, and it starts out really thin at the point and then tapers and gets really wide, so it leaves these really nasty cuts. And some of these were pretty short too. They're not that long. Here's one down here. It shows a guy. I don't know if you guys can see it, but some of them were pretty darn short. And it was a nasty little dagger. It was a really nasty little dagger.
Yeah, getting stabbed by one of these would not have been great. It would leave a massive sucking wound. And also, as I explained earlier, it was also used by the Romans as a sort of makeshift shovel. So they could use that to clear away like dirt and dig out trenches because it was so wide. It was effectively like like a digging implement. Which means that the weapon was also probably very dirty. They didn't clean them, you know. So if you got stabbed by that, it was probably going to leave not only a horrendous sucking wound, but one that was likely to get infected.
Gnarly little blade there. One thing that kind of makes me look crazy is some of these. Why is it that pictures of people in medieval armor, they're always wearing bracers? Like, bracers were not really a thing, you know? So that makes me kind of crazy. But yeah, very, very cool design. Really nasty dagger, nasty little weapon. And it's not like in Dungeons and Dragons where you get stabbed with one of these and you take 1d4 damage and that's it. You get plunged with one of these Pugios, you're done. You're cooked. If you survive, it'll be a miracle. All right, Mr. Tristan, what we got next, sir?
Well, that's because in real life everyone is a peasant class, so you have like 5 hit. Drugger here is asking, do you think Caesar died by these? And these would be the type of dagger that Caesar would have
Absolutely.
been put by.
Absolutely. These are probably the exact daggers that put down the great Julius Caesar. So,
Though an interesting bit of historical information here. When Caesar was assassinated, he himself was a famously a military man, but most of the senators were not. They were, you know, bougie rich guys, right? And so when Caesar's body was examined, he had like 47 wounds that were medically understood to have been of no serious issue. It was effectively just a flesh wound. And only the last one, which was traditionally delivered by Brutus, was actually a death blow.
Jesus. I can imagine that those guys probably swarmed him and he's just like kicking their asses and pushing them back and fuck. It's crazy that the entire Senate with blades in their hands, it took all of them to take down Caesar. What a fucking Chad.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them probably weren't really trying. They wanted to like get in a dagger blow so they could claim that they were in on it because, you know, they figured if you're gonna win, you might as well be on the winning side, right? But these weren't military men. They didn't know how to handle anyone. They had never killed anyone before, and Caesar was a very intimidating force. The entire assassination plot was almost stopped because when they grabbed Caesar, he yelled, "What do you mean to do for me? This is violence." And they like froze up and almost didn't do anything.
What a bunch of pussies. All right, what do we got up? What we got next, Mr. Tristan? We got time for maybe two more.
Two more. Okay, then let's go for the steppe peoples, and they have a composite bow. A very cool introduction here. Everyone knows what a bow is, the long bow, a recurve bow, but the composite bow was really a force on the ancient battlefield that allowed steppe people of all sorts, from, you know, Scythians to Mongols, to really dominate the ancient world.
Oh, here we go.
Right. So effectively, the main difference here is that a composite bow is, as the name would imply, made from two different substances, primarily horn tips from cattle, where you use glued on each end of them, and then the twine of the bow was attached to the horn instead of the actual wood of the bow, and this allowed it to maintain much more pressure, allowed much more generation of force. It allowed the bow to be much shorter, which was allowed for them to use it on horseback. If you notice here, like if when you see them doing it, these bows are actually very tiny compared to like an English longbow, like an infantry bow you would see. So that's why they would allow them from horseback. They could shoot them perfectly fine. And a composite bow, because of its unique method as with the horns glued on the top of it, they could shoot farther than an English longbow could, even from horseback. They're very accurate. Their only main design weakness was because they used glue as a primary method of its construction, that if they went into any sort of like tropical or humid climates, or rain or anything like that, would literally destroy the bow and they would fall apart, which is primarily one of the reasons why the Mongols didn't invade into Germania, because the Germanic forests were too wet for them to use their bows.
Yeah, this was like, I was just talking to my wife earlier about the Mongols, man. They could have, like, they were really, really an incredible fighting force. Probably one top five most incredible fighting forces ever in history. They were waging war. They were they conquered all of the steppe. They were going into India and China. They went into Arabia. They went into Europe. They were all over, man. They were a hell of a force. And they watch that, what's that one channel that does a lot of the video, Kings and Generals. They have so many videos about the Mongol, and just watching these videos talking about these Mongol battles, they just decimated everybody. It was like nobody ever had a chance against these guys because of how not just like how great their specialized their technology was, but how disciplined they were. They were just
trying. Yeah, that's something that never really gets talked about with the Mongols, is that these were a very disciplined, professional, strategic, well-educated fighting force. Their commanders knew military tactics and how to manipulate and manage other armies and themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. They pretty much just outsmarted everybody all the time. They were just they never got goaded into doing dumb stuff. They were just incredible, and they knew when to retreat. They were just an incredible fighting force.
Yeah, absolutely. And the composite bow here was central to their dominance.
Yeah.
Of all the steppe peoples, really, because you can't really use like a longer infantry bow. Like if we see up here, they have the an English longbow right in front of a person who's shooting it, and it's almost as tall as he is. You can't use that from horseback. It just doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. English longbow, while it's a tremendous, tremendous weapon, it's not a mobile weapon. It takes a lot of strength to draw it. It's just not something you want to use on horseback. You could, on horseback, these little things, first of all, they're very light. They're nifty. The arrows themselves, you can carry quite a few of them. It was just a tremendous, tremendous weapon. But the English longbow, as far as infantry archers, that was the stuff right there.
Right. So for the last one, Dave, why don't you pick which one you would rather do? We can do the Dane axe or the hewing spear.
We got to do the Dane axe.
Let's go with that. The iconic Dane axe.
Dane axe.
It cemented everyone's idea of the Viking period. Everyone thinks of a big hulking Norseman with a two-handed axe. So the Dane axe was actually one of the primary weaponry of the noble classes of the professional warriors of the Viking period. The Húskarls of the king. If you were a king's man, you would traditionally have been armed with a Dane axe, and these people were armored up in full mail and helmet and, you know, greaves and everything like that, and strode onto the battlefield with this massive weapon and just went to town on, you know, the militia and the conscripts and everyone around them, and they would butcher everyone, bash right through shields, pull them apart, hook people in, drag them down to the line, slam them into them. And you can see a lot of them are also angled in such a fashion where you could actually stab with the point of the axe as well.
Yeah, the bearded axes.
And they were surprisingly light. One of the main differences, like people think of an axe as being very heavy because of a woodsman's axe, but These are very light weapons. If you look at the blade, they taper extremely well. They're very, very narrow. They're extremely light and easy to manage. Super good inventions.
We're talking these axe heads might be 2 pounds, 2-3 pounds max.
Yeah, might. That's even put 3 pounds would be really pushing it.
Yeah, we're talking a pound and a half. These were very, very light, very light, nimble, very quick weapons. They were, they had a very long haft. They had a very long handle to them, so they had great reach. They were great for pulling down shields. You'd pull down a shield and you'd thrust up and stab into the guy. You could hack the guy. There's just videos all over online. People chopping up.
Yeah, one of the best. Yeah, one of the best things to use with it is because it had such a long two-handed haft on it, you could vary up what the what your positioning of it is. So you could put your hands at the very bottom and go for like an extremely long swing. You're maybe getting 8 or 9 feet, depending on your own size and length on that. Or you could get for like a smaller two-handed version, rush a person and fight in close combat. And when you're fighting in a warfare scenario like that, being able to vary your strokes and the amount of your threat range, it makes it very, very tough to get a read on you. And a lot of less trained people will basically just die because they thought they were safe and they didn't realize they're actually within your threat range.
Yeah. Kind of the technique that they used with these Dane axes was you would have your shield wall. And then a guy that was standing right behind the first line of shield wall would just rain down with these axes and just smash into the other row until they would break the formation, and then they would just charge in and start hacking people up like meat. They were incredible weapons, really incredible.
Yeah, lot of it I have to really specify here that the Dane axe was really a weaponry of the noble classes. So when you're thinking of a warrior armed with a Dane axe, we're not talking about like a barbarian in leather. This was a professional soldier attired in thick king's mail with a metal helmet and armored up to the nines. And that was why they have sacrificed defense using the two-handed weaponry, was because they didn't need it. Fighting most people, they could just shrug off any sort of blow. They were huge professional soldiers, well-muscled, well-trained, they ate really well, and they would just bulldoze over everyone else.
Yeah.
And when these people came up to them, they were terrified because they looked like a lord of war.
Yeah. And the Hollywood image of the barbarians just, like, charging in, wearing furs and paint on their faces and having two weapons, that throw that in the trash. The Norse people, their fighting forces, these were people that spent their lives training. These were professional, sophisticated, educated men of superior warfare. They were the Roman legionnaires of the time. They were incredible.
I mean, they very much were probably the best trained and disciplined military force in Europe until the beginning of like the middle of the Middle Ages. Once they started having Well, maybe a little earlier than Renaissance, but maybe like the 1200s. Yeah. Until about that period, the Norsemen were the dominant military force on the entire continent. And you would read about them consistently just utterly crushing.
We lost you, Tristan.
You know, army after army that they came up with, because the only people were effective. Even the normal Norseman of the time period was so well trained and disciplined in warfare, just from youth and raiding and that sort of thing, in comparison to like his continental or British Isles counterparts, that they were effectively all professional soldiers fighting like conscripts and infantrymen, and they would just mow them apart. Like you would, when you find in the early Danish invasions of England, they just crush English after English army, raiding in the Carolingian Empire. Unless you actually got them with like a force massively larger than them, they'd utterly wreck you. I mean, these people were extremely well feared.
Yeah. Pretty much the only thing that stopped the Viking Age were stone castles.
Understand fortifications or siege warfare, and they didn't have the time or patience because they were primarily raiders. So if they wanted to hit you and get out, right? So they didn't have the time period to sit around for 6 months while they slowly whittle down your forces in a siege. They couldn't do that.
That's not what they were specialized for. They were specialized for quick. They were quick people. They were athletic. Their boats were very light. So they were specialized for quick, effective viper strikes of infantry fighting. They weren't equipped or specialized to take on a castle, right? So when we got into the Irish, actually in Ireland, they have these big giant stone towers, and their solution for the Viking raids was they would have these stone towers, and when a horn would go off to alert them that they were getting raided, they would just grab everything that's important to them, all of their family, and they would climb these rope ladders into these towers that had the door at the top, and they would just pull the ladders up and just hide in these towers until the Vikings would leave.
Yeah, in the early medieval period, the only way of defeating the Vikings was to not fight the Vikings.
Yeah, they were tough. They were tough people. But, I absolutely hate how Hollywood portrays them. It makes me sick. I hate how they portray...
Oh, I hate it as well, because they always go for, like, this barbarian chic behavior, and it's ridiculous and completely ahistorical.
Like, up here, this lady here. This lady is not... Like, this is fucking LARP. I hate this, you know. It's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous, and it's not just the Viking Age. The Germanic people as a whole, the peoples of the Norse, of the North, whether you're talking the mainland Germanic people or the Norse people, these were very sophisticated, intelligent people that had great engineering marvel. They were just great people. They were civilized people. They weren't these, like, idiot backwoods barbarians that had crap on their face and just ran into danger.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much the case. Any sort of portrayal of them as, like, primitive, like, basically Stone Age barbarians in leather chic, like, you know, biker jackets and everything like that. This is completely ahistorical. It did not exist. Especially when we're talking about the noble classes at this period, the Norsemen and Germanic people at large were armored in mail with metal helmets and large shields and professional weaponry, and they had tactics and wrestling and martial arts and all of these other things.
Yeah, they were...
They were actual professional warriors.
They were... they had more in common with, like, a knight of the late medieval period than they did with any type of you know, Hollywood barbarian. And in fact, many of the knight lineages, the guys that went on to fight in the Crusades and later on, were descended from Vikings.
Oh yeah, there is basically an unbroken chain from these periods that, especially in, like, the Norman kingdoms and into the Germanic areas, people went literally from being a Germanic Huscarl to a later, like, Frankish knight. And the only difference was the language they used to speak of it.
Yeah. And you can see here, here's a really good one that shows how long the haft was on this Dane axe. This is the predecessor to the halberd, to the glaive, to all of the pole arms that dominated the late medieval and Renaissance periods up until they invented
Interestingly, we think that the Vikings actually had a very common, like, halberd sort of glaive weaponry. We have the word for it in the sagas, and they talk about it a little bit, but vague enough that we don't actually know what it looked like. We don't have any archaeological finds, except that it was effectively a weapon that they were used and were familiar with. And it was probably some sort of, like, pole arm, like a halberd or a glaive or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. Very, very cool. Unfortunately, Mr. Tristan, we have run out of time. We didn't get a chance to get into the late medieval period and getting the crossbows and trebuchets and all that. But we'll save it for another time.
Yeah, we'll do a part two for this and go for late medieval classic era weaponry and everything. That'll be very fun. Everyone's super familiar with.
Yeah, very cool. So I appreciate everybody for tuning in tonight. We'll be back next week, 6 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, we can talk about it.
Mr. Tristan's coming. He's going in and out with his internet there. But we're gonna shut it down for this evening, and we'll be back next week, 6 p.m. Eastern, Friday. I'll see you guys then. But before we close out, our final plugs. If you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, so on and so forth. But most importantly, you get RSS feed to get the audio of every single show that we do to listen to in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/TheBog. You want to support The Bog another way, make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop. And get yourself a hoodie, get yourself a beanie, get yourself all kinds of cool stuff to keep you warm during these cold winter months. If you're up here in the Northeast, man, we got a nor'easter coming. It's going to get pretty chilly. Get yourself a Bog hoodie, bro. Keep you warm. But we also got dresses for the ladies and onesies for the babies over there at shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop. You can check out a friend of ours at facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. That is authentic Vedic astrology. Really, really cool stuff. If you decide to get a reading, tell him Big Dave sent you. But just go over there, see what he's got going on, give him a like. That is facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. Bizarrechives, guys. Bizarrechives. Weird tales of monsters, magic, and machines. We've got all kinds of cool. We got 3 books already. In 6 months, we put out 3 books. All awesome. We got Bizarrechives 1, Bizarrechives 2, featuring the incredible art of the mighty Donald Kent. And then Bizarrechives Presents, a cosmic horror double feature by our boy A. Cuthbertson. Really, really great stuff. So if you like fiction, if you want to get into some casual reading, and you want to support based indie publishing, go to thebizarrechives.com. I guarantee you you're going to like it. So go over there. And if you run a business, if you got a storefront or a retailer or something like that, you're some sort of merchant and you got something going on there and you want to buy some bulk, hit me up. You can send me a email at thebizarrechives@gmail.com. If you are interested in submitting to the Bizarrechives, you can go to thebizarrechives.com and check out submission criteria. And like always, we're going to raise a horn. Where's my horn at? Here we go. I'm going to raise a horn to our most exalted patrons. Our very own Mr. Andre, who hasn't been with us for a while. He's having some technical issues. And our friend Mr. Corey. Because of them, we can maintain our program here with their great generosity. So hail to Corey, and hail to Andre, and hail to each and every one of you bog lords and bog maidens out there. Much love, many hails, and many blessings to each and every one of you and your wonderful, beautiful families. And I'll see you guys next week right here, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Bog. Hail.